Good evening. This morning I was inspired by Greg talking about just the importance of practice, or he didn't use these words, but somehow this kind of what an honorable, beautiful thing to be doing. To be practicing, spending this time. I was reflecting on the great good fortune that all of us can come together and have this time devoted to seeing more clearly, understanding ourselves, understanding the world. And in my view, this is exactly what the world needs. So it touches me deeply that there are people that come together to do this practice. So thank you. Thank you for your practice. I also was inspired when Andrea, speaking 2 days ago, she ended her talk with, "It's possible," pointing to awakening, right? That's, it's possible. And with that in mind, I invite you to listen to this poem. Listen to this poem with a mind and a heart that has been practicing. Whether you've been here for the March retreat or the February retreat, all of us have been touched and are a little bit different than when we arrived. Maybe it's not clear to us at this moment exactly how we're different, but all this time practicing does have an impact. So here's this poem. Plowing fields with plows, sowing seeds in the ground, caring for children and family, people gain wealth. Why is it that I, thorough in virtuous conduct, doing the Buddha's instruction, not lazy or proud, have not attained release? I watched the water, the foot washing water, flow from high ground to low. With this, the mind concentrated, like a thoroughbred horse. Taking an oil lamp, I entered my hut. Looking over the bed, I sat on the bed. Taking a needle, I pulled out the wick. As the flame went out, the mind was freed. This poem begins with this person noticing that other people seem to be getting the results they want. The farmers, the people who have families. They're gaining wealth. It's a way to say they're participating in the economy and whatever it might be. And this person is doing what they believe should be done. But they're not getting the results that they wish that they had. They're following the instructions the teacher gave. Maybe this person's feeling a little bit of frustration or confusion. But then there's something about watching the water roll downhill, which water does. It rolls downhill. In the same way that Anushka dropped those spoons the very first Dharma talk, it's just natural, right? And there's this way in which kind of like aligning with nature, aligning with the reality of gravity, with nothing extra, just aligning with the way things are. And then pulling out the wick, turning off the lamp, this shift from light to dark. All of a sudden, there's nothing to hold on to. The senses don't have anything to hold on to. The aggregates aren't clinging. The mind is freed. I appreciate that this pulling out the wick, we could say, is some in-betweening. This activity of some particular thing that probably this person has done again and again, countless times. But this particular time, the conditions were such that there was this deep letting go. This deep letting go and not trying to control anything. Just aligning, being present for what was happening. Some of you may recognize this poem. This poem is by Padachara. It's one of the preeminent nuns at the time of the Buddha. She was a teacher of other nuns. And she came to the practice after experiencing tragedy after heartbreaking tragedy. Her husband died unexpectedly. First one child dies, and then another one. Then her parents die. Like, just the heartbreak of this. Just crazed with grief. And then she meets the Buddha, and the Buddha gives her a teaching. And she practiced. She describes herself as following this virtuous conduct, so the way that she was in the world, the way she interacted with others, she practiced. She describes herself as not lazy or proud, so the right amount of effort, not too much, not too little. And creating the conditions in which the mind could be concentrated. And she becomes awakened. There's a way in which we can be inspired by these stories, by these poems about people's awakening experience. Some of you may know that there's a collection of them, hundreds of them, women and men who are finding their way to awakening. And these have been preserved for thousands of years. And there's a way, for me, they have this timeless quality. Maybe we don't have foot washing water, but we do have this water going downhill. Maybe we don't pull out the wick, but we flip a switch. So the Buddhist scriptures have both these lists, which things are very organized, systematized, categorized. And they have poems and stories, which are maybe less systematized, but are a way and can touch us, inspire us, maybe a different part that gets inspired or gets activated or engaged than the lists, the numbered lists. And I would say we need both. Some of the categories and some of the poems and the stories. Maybe there's different seasons of our practice in which just we feel more touched by the narratives, the stories, or the poems, and the categories feel bothersome and troublesome. Maybe there are seasons in practice where it's the other way, where we have the lists, and it's so helpful to feel like 1, 2, 3, 4. And maybe the category or the stories and the poems don't quite touch us. And for me, I just feel, I don't know, so appreciative that there's both. And to recognize that sometimes I have preferences for one or the other. Probably all of us have preferences for one way or the other. But, you know, there's a richness to humans. And there's a time when maybe the one way or the other can be a support for us. So to make room for both ways in which we might receive the teachings, hear the teachings, resonate with the teachings. Maybe I'll add that sometimes, or there's this expression, beautiful, and it's a little different. This week you might think of a spiritual beauty, a little bit different, or maybe very different than the idea of thing being like visually pleasing. Instead, this idea of beautiful is something that's an inner experience of some goodness or... I wish I had better synonyms for this word beautiful, but... And there's some passages in the suttas that talk about the Dharma as beautiful in the beginning, beautiful in the middle, and beautiful in the end. And so maybe there's these different teachings have beauty in different ways. So the invitation tonight is to allow yourself to be touched by the beauty, what I think is beautiful, as I share a few more poems about awakening. So here's one more. Though I'm skinny, sick, and very feeble, I climb the mountain, leaning on a staff. Having laid down my outer robe and overturned my bowl, propping myself against a rock, I shattered the mass of darkness. In this poem, this person is climbing a mountain, and in some ways, we are all climbing a mountain. One step after another, maybe with some difficulties, maybe it feels particularly steep on particular times, but in a way that practice isn't always easy, and it can feel like a really big mountain sometimes. And I appreciate very much that in this poem she's, here it's translated as staff, but we might think of like a cane. She's using something to help herself. What a wise thing to do. Sometimes we need help. And it can come in so many different forms. So maybe our abilities are such that we could use a little bit of help. Our physical abilities, our inner abilities. And then when she gets to the top, maybe it's not even the top, maybe she's still climbing the mountain, she puts everything down. the alms bowl, the robe, the body? What would it be like for you to put everything down? And she writes, shattering the mass of darkness, the darkness of ignorance, of not having the light of insight, not having the light that allows us to see clearly. Kind of in the same way, in their earlier poem was this shift from light to dark, and now here's the shift from dark to light. Just this shift of seeing things differently, it's different conditions. There's another poet who, inspired by this, the poem that I just read, wrote another poem. It goes like this. Somehow I kept climbing, though tired, hungry, and weak, old too. At the top of the mountain, I spread my outer robe on a rock to dry, set down my staff and bowl, took a deep breath and looked around. It was windy up there. As I was leaning back against a large gray rock, the darkness that I had carried up and down a million mountains slipped off my shoulders and swept itself away on the wind. I love this idea. Swept itself away on the wind. No longer being held, no longer being clung to. Off it goes. Here's another poem. And this one, this person talks about went forth, which is an expression that talks about or represents ordination. In the 25 years since I went forth, I don't know that I ever found serenity in my mind. I had failed to find peace of heart or any control over my mind. When I remembered the victor's instructions, I was struck with a sense of urgency. Though subject to so many painful things, I have, through my love of diligence, reached the ending of craving and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. This is the seventh day since my craving dried up. Here's another person who's practicing diligently. She wasn't able to find peace and she wanted to control the mind, but wasn't able to. 25 years, she didn't disrobe. She kept practicing. In whatever way was available to her. And she remembers the Buddha's instructions. And maybe you've had this same experience where something that you've heard so many times that all of a sudden it makes sense in a different way. I know I've had this happen to me. Like, oh, that's what they were talking about. Thousands of years ago, this was happening to people. Also, this, when the time is right, somehow the conditions are right, things that we've heard again and again touch us in a different way. We understand it a little bit differently. And she practices. And then her awakening is described as the ending of craving. This letting go of, wanting things to be different. Wanting something, just not being satisfied, this wanting something. So that poem that I just read was from the Therigatta, so been preserved for all these, for thousands of years. And then, inspired by that poem, another poet wrote a poem. And that poem goes like this. After 25 years on the path, I'd experienced almost everything except peace. When I was young, my mother told me that I would find true happiness only in marriage. Remembering her words all those years later, something in me began to tremble. I gave myself to the trembling, and it showed me all the pain this little heart had ever known, and how countless lives of searching had brought me at last to the present moment, which I happily married. Can you imagine? We've been living together ever since without a single argument. There's something delightful about this idea of just marrying the present moment. This was, her way. Society, her mother told her things should be one particular way, but she made it work for her. And I'm imagining, I don't know exactly how it was thousands of years ago, but I'm imagining, there was a lot of pressure to show up in a particular way, to be a particular way. And she found her own way within that. I feel inspired by that. So, with these poems that I'm sharing, there's a few themes probably you've noticed. Having difficulties. The first poem, it felt like everybody else was getting the results they wanted, but she wasn't. The sense of comparing and the sense of, seems like the fruits of our labors, the fruits of our work should be evident. But right when we're with the mind and the heart, it's not so evident in the way that we expect it or the way that we wish it would be. In the second poem, this person climbing up a mountain feeling weak and yet finding the way with a cane, one step after the other. And in this third poem, not finding peace despite practicing 25 years. Another theme is just this idea of practicing. Simply, we don't know exactly what they're doing, but I'm imagining it's not very different than what we're doing. Just one moment after the next. Right, all the teachers were bringing teachings that are from the Buddha, from the time of these same people were practicing. And then awakening, of course, is another theme, and it's getting described in different ways in these poems. Padacharya talks about the mind being freed, like no longer bound up, no longer tied up, tangled up with greed, hatred, and delusion, or the fetters, or whatever it is it gets tangled up with. The second poem, Citta, I didn't tell you that was the name of the nun. She shatters the mass of darkness from going from not being able to see to being able to see. Sometimes the Buddha is described as this way, as bringing a lamp to other people so that they might see. And the third poem, kind of the awakening, is described as the ending of craving. I appreciate so much. It's not like one exact description that happens exactly the same for everybody. Instead, there's these different ways that it gets expressed. The different ways, maybe based on how they were in their life or how it shows up, but all of that pointing to this non-clinging, this non-grasping, this deep letting go. And I'd like to read one more poem. This one is from Meghya. He was the Buddha's attendant before Ananda. And his poem goes like this. He counseled me, the great hero, the one who has gone beyond all things. When I heard his teaching, I stayed close by him, mindful. I've attained the three knowledges and fulfilled the Buddha's instructions. So Meghya recognized that the Buddha, somebody who had gone beyond, and he felt, and Meghya recognized, it's worthwhile to stick around and hear these teachings. And so he did. He was the Buddha's attendant. He was there, present at all the teachings, supporting the Buddha. He describes his awakening as attaining the three knowledges. For some of you who know the story of the Buddha's awakening, he has the same expression, attaining the three knowledges. So here's Meghya, who has a similar awakening as the Buddha. It's not exactly the same as the Buddha, partly because the Buddha found his own way without a teacher, whereas Meghya had this great teacher. Some might say the world's greatest teacher for meditation, for awakening. But, of course, Meghya, he has a story too, and there's a whole sutta that's devoted to this, his story. And it goes like this. So Meghya, he goes for alms rounds. And while he's on alms rounds, he sees this delightful mango grove and has this idea, oh, this would be a great place to practice. So when he comes back from his alms rounds, he goes to the Buddha and says, I saw this mango grove I'd like to practice. I'd like to go there, spend the day there. And the Buddha says, no, Meghya, now is not the time for you to go. We're alone. Please wait. I don't know if he said please. Wait until there's another practitioner here. So Meghya, in his role as the attendant, was expected that he would be there to attend to the Buddha, and the Buddha was saying, that was not the time to go. And then for me, a little bit surprising, that Meghya, he tries to convince the Buddha. And he says to the Buddha, for you, there is nothing further to do, and no need to increase what has been done. Recognizing that the Buddha doesn't need to practice. And then Meghya says, for me, there is more to be done. There is a need to increase what has been done. So he's saying, look, I'm not awakened. You're awakened. I'm not. I want to go practice. And the Buddha says, no, for a second time. Megia asks him again, giving the same rationale. And for the third time, the Buddha says, okay, if you really want to go meditate, you can go meditate. So Megia goes. He goes to this mango grove to practice. And while he is there, he has a hard time. And he describes it that he's meditating and there's three kinds of unhelpful thoughts frequently occurred to him. Sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. Here's somebody who has dedicated his life to practice, is a monastic, has the Buddha as a teacher, goes to practice, has a hard time. He comes back and he reports to the Buddha. And he says to that Buddha, he says, let me see, I'm finding the quote here. He says, it is astounding and amazing. I have gone forth, I have ordained, out of faith from the household life into homelessness, yet I am still stalked by these three kinds of unhelpful thoughts. Despite all this practice dedicating his life, he's disappointed that he still has these types of thoughts. So the Buddha gives him some instructions. He says, Megia, there are these five conditions to support a maturation of the heart's release. We could also translate it as, Megia, when the heart's release is not ripe, five things help it ripen. Or we could also say, there are five conditions that when liberation of mind has not matured, help it mature. Heart's release, liberation of mind. The Buddha is using this type of language to support Megia, and here I am with a list, right? So what are these five things? What are these five conditions to help kind of have this ripen of the heart's release, the liberation of the mind? The first one is having some spiritual companions that support practice. Maybe in exactly the same way we support each other. When we show up to the hall, when we keep silence. And all the small ways in which this would be such a different retreat if you were here by yourself. Right, the community we're practicing together. So that's the first condition, is to have some spiritual companions to support practice. The second is to behave ethically, which we're doing here. We've taken the precepts, and frankly, there's not a lot of opportunities to not behave ethically here. The third condition is to hear at will, without trouble or difficulty, talk concerned with the practice life that is conducive to opening up the heart. So having access to the teachings. Back then, of course, the teachings were only by talk. They weren't books. They weren't written down. So that's the third condition, is to have access to the teachings without difficulty. Of course, here you guys are, right, listening to a Dharma talk. How many Dharma talks and instructions, and Brahma Vihara sits? The fourth condition is arousing energy for abandoning that which is unhelpful, those unhelpful qualities, and energy for acquiring, arousing the helpful qualities. And part of this practice that we've been doing is to help us see and discern the difference between the unhelpful and the helpful. And to have some enough energy, whatever energy, whatever amount of energy you have, it's enough to help us make this discernment, what's helpful, what's not helpful. And as best we can we put down that which is not helpful and cultivate that which is helpful? So that's the fourth condition. And the fifth is to have the wisdom that discerns arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. So here the Buddha is talking about seeing impermanence in a really penetrating way. All of us know things are impermanent in some kind of way. We know the seasons change. We know that things end. But maybe you have this experience that as the mind is quieting, we're seeing more and more the subtle ways in which things are impermanent, the subtle ways in which things are inconstant, maybe flickering or fleeting, arising then ending. And there can be a way in which when we see this flickering, this things that are changing and ending, it just doesn't make sense to be holding on anymore to things that are just ending. So there's just naturally a letting go. In the same way that there's this letting go that we saw in these other poems. So Meghia, he becomes awakened with these, cultivating with these five conditions that help us create the conditions for the heart's release or the liberation of the mind. I feel very touched by this story of Meghia. He seemed like very sincere, like he really wanted to practice, and he was the Buddha's attendant, and yet it wasn't easy. He still had difficulties, and for me personally, not always easy, and had plenty of difficulties, lots of dukkha. I'm guessing there is not a single teacher, there is not a single practitioner, there is not anybody who doesn't start this practice who doesn't have difficulties in dukkha. I've had seasons that were really tough. But there was something inside of me, and I can't tell you exactly what it was, but there was something inside of me that recognized or understood or saw, trusted that this was a path. This was a path for me, and just like the way it was a path for countless people through these thousands of years. Maybe these individuals, these poems, show us that it is possible. Just like Andrea said, it is possible to find our way to peace, freedom, awakening. And maybe I'll end with this poem. This one is not from the suttas, but again is inspired by the suttas, and I don't know why exactly, but it really touches me. Maybe the whimsy and the tenderness. I'll share it with you here. Maybe it'll touch you also, maybe not too. While walking along the river, after a long day meditating on Vulture Peak, I watched an elephant splashing its way out of the water and up the bank. "Hello, my friend," a man waiting there said, scratching the elephant behind its ear. "Did you have a good bath?" The elephant stretched out its leg. The man climbed up, and the two rode off like that, together. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good man, I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to the woods. Seeing what had once been so wild, now a friend and companion to this good person, I took a seat under the nearest tree and reached out a gentle hand to my own mind. Truly, I thought, this is why I came to the woods. So let's sit for a little bit. So may we all contribute a verse to the poem of the human race. May our practice be for the benefit of all beings, everywhere, without exception. Thank you. Thank you for your practice and your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.